Comes from the book of Luke, chapter 15, verses 1 through 10. It can be found in your pew Bibles on page 874. Please stand for the reading of God's word. Now the tax collectors and the sinners were all drawing near to hear him. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost." Just so I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance.
For what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost." Just so, I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. This is the living word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated.
Thank you, you guys. If I may, just one word. The pastors of our church, 8 of us meet together for prayer on the first Monday of each month, and that is tomorrow. We would like to pray for you specifically if you have a specific need. We would like you to be honest if you do, and find your way to a computer and email us. The address is seniorpastor@pcpc.org. Seniorpastor@pcpc.org, and just include whatever it is you'd like for us to pray for you tomorrow. We will be collecting those early tomorrow morning, so you have until then to send them to us, and we will be glad to pray for you. Don't forget the concert tonight and the privilege we have of being together to sing and rejoice and praise together at 7 p.m. In this room. It's a great time to bring friends. Now, what I want to say this morning is in some ways a compliment and a charge to our high school seniors. It is a compliment in this sense, that I think many of you have taught us in this church an awful lot in the last many years. And what you have taught us is how to be honest about what isn't going right in our lives. You've taught us to be somewhat out front about what isn't working, about where the problems are, where in our Christian lives things don't seem to be going along as sweetly and as hunky-dory as sometimes we want to think. And I want to congratulate you in that particular regard and thank you. And in a sense, I dedicate this message to you because you're showing us the way to do what I want to tell the rest of the church we must do this morning. In Luke chapter 15, there are three parables about three lost objects: lost sheep, lost coin, and lost sons. We're going to look at the first two of those this morning and save the last one, the so-called parable of the prodigal son, until another time later on. The most notable word in some ways is here at the beginning of verse 3. It is the word "so." In other words, what Jesus has just been saying is that the tax collectors and the sinners gathered around him, and the Pharisees saw this and they were upset about it. And so Jesus tells them, meaning the Pharisees, this parable. It is in light of the accumulation of people that gather around Jesus right here, the combination of people that gather around him. On the one hand, as I said, there's tax collectors. Now, the Romans sold the right to collect taxes to the members of the local population. So some of the Jewish people would buy the right to collect taxes, and then they would collect the taxes from their own people. They would collect as much as they could. In other words, they would try and collect over and above what the Romans were requiring, and that way, that's the way they made their profit. They would pocket the rest of what they collected. Needless to say, they were not the most popular people among their own kind. They were the ones who enriched themselves at their countrymen's expense. They were seen as cooperating with the Roman authorities and helping the Romans subjugate the local population, so they weren't popular at all. That's the tax collectors. Who are the sinners? Well, the sinners are those who were perceived by the Pharisees to be immoral. And I use the word "perceived" very significantly. In other words, the Pharisees didn't care, and this is a key, so much about real behavior. They cared about perceived behavior. They cared about what things looked like. They cared about whether things were all buttoned down and clean and neat according to the law. And that was their biggest burden, more than the reality of what was going on in people's hearts. Tax collectors and sinners were coming near. Christ welcomes them. This is the issue. The Pharisees grumbled. They would not associate with people like this. They would not appear with people who appeared to be either tax collectors or sinners, even to teach them the law. The Pharisees believed that it was their whole duty to avoid anything which would contaminate their sanctity. Alarm bells would go off when they were in the presence of a person they perceived to be a sinner. And sometimes we, unfortunately, see this in Christians today. People who are shocked, our moral security systems go off when we're around a person who doesn't fit the mold of what we think a nice, sweet Christian ought to be. I'm here to tell you something this morning. I'm going to say it very directly right now. None of us are nice, sweet Christians the way we ought to be. All of us have more in common with the tax collector and the sinner than we do, certainly with the Pharisees, I hope, and certainly with any of those who are righteous, really righteous. Every one of us is a person who stands in need. No matter how real sin is in our lives, it shouldn't shock us. And the reason is because we know something about ourselves. We know a secret. We know the deepest secret of all. It's the gospel secret. And the gospel secret tells us this: we are far worse off than we could ever imagine. There is really bad stuff going on in our lives and in our hearts. And secondly, we are far better off than we could ever dream, because the gospel is the answer to the deepest needs in all of our lives. Certainly, sin should not cause us to retreat into isolation like it did the Pharisees. The tone and the tenor of the New Testament in this matter is absolutely unequivocally clear. It is always the command of Jesus, Paul, the other writers in the New Testament, that Christians not isolate themselves from trouble, from difficulty, from people who are in trouble and difficulty, and even sin. It is always that Christians are to enter into the world aware, guarded to be sure, so we don't get personally sloppy, I suppose, about it, but moving among men and women of this world with a graciousness and a winsomeness. Paul said in Philippians 2:25, Christians are to be shown as blameless and innocent children of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world. But sometimes Christians are more like sirens than lights when they're in the presence of things they don't like. Sometimes we Christians are high on judgment and very low on grace. This man receives sinners, the Pharisee says. He welcomes them. There's two words for welcome in the Greek language. One means just to welcome in the ordinary sense. One means to welcome into closest fellowship, to draw close. And that's symbolized by eating together, because eating was almost like a sacramental thing in the ancient Middle East. And therefore, Jesus is scandalizing the Pharisees because he eats with sinners. And it says the Pharisees grumbled, they murmured. They either mumbled among themselves or they sent insinuating rumors through the crowd. The undercurrent of discontent, this rumblings, eventually at the end of the Gospels becomes what? Screams. Crucify him, crucify him. But right now they're just rumblings. I want to remind you that in the Gospels, and particularly in the Gospel of Luke, the deepest meanings are in the twists or the surprises or the things that you don't expect. But sometimes we're so used to the words that we have to read them more carefully in order to get those surprises. For example, the end of chapter 14, it says, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." That's what Jesus says. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Then the chapter 15 begins with verse 1. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him. So who is the one who has the ears to hear? Jesus is saying that those you would expect to hear actually don't hear. They listen, but they don't hear. But those who the religious people, the people who seem to have it all together, would expect would hear, they're the ones who actually open their hearts, open their lives, contrary to the Pharisees who close their hearts and close their lives to the very teaching that they are supposed to receive. It is sinners who really hear. It is not those who think they are righteous. So the parable, Jesus tells, begins. What man of you having 100 sheep, if he has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? Now, you need to understand something about the way Jesus talks here to really understand the meaning. In the ancient Middle East, if a bank president was addressed, he would never be addressed as if he were an office boy. Rank was everything in the ancient Middle East. In fact, when people of a lower class would come into the presence of people of a higher class or a social order, they would always dress up their language. They would try and say lofty words in very artificial way in order to sound really important. A king, if a king was addressed as a street sweeper, he would be very, very angry. Rank was everything. And the villagers here are shocked when they hear Jesus addressing the Pharisees as if they were what? Shepherds. He tells a story about sheep, but he tells it to the Pharisees. And this would be something the Pharisees would take great offense at. You know, if you were a Pharisee and you owned sheep, you would never take care of them yourself. You would always hire a shepherd, because sheep and shepherds were considered about the lowliest and dirtiest things in the ancient Middle East. So the Pharisees are insulted at the approach Jesus takes. The parable itself portrays the trouble that a real shepherd will find when he goes to look for the lost sheep. Now, sheep would easily nibble their way into oblivion. In other words, they would follow the grass until they ran out of grass, but they may be in a distant place and they didn't know how to get back home, and they would starve to death and be lost. And Jesus says, suppose you lose one of them. Now, again, in the Middle East, they would never put it this way. You would never blame yourself for losing anything. If you miss a train, you wouldn't say, I missed the train. You'd say, the train left without me. If you lost your pen, you wouldn't say, I lost my pen. You'd say, my pen left me. In other words, nobody would take any blame for anything, especially the Pharisees. But here it says that the shepherd takes the initiative. The shepherd goes, he finds the sheep, he puts the sheep on his shoulders, he comes back rejoicing. Now, actually, most shepherds would hope they would find the sheep dead, eaten by animals, so that they wouldn't have to go through the difficulty of putting the sheep on their shoulders and carrying it back home. But that's in contrast with a real shepherd, Jesus says, who is thrilled when he finds lost sheep. And he rejoices with the community. Why with the community? As each of the parables say. Why? Because the sheep would be owned by the village together. You wouldn't own individual sheep. The whole village would own a flock. And so if one sheep was lost, it would cost something to everybody in the village. The Pharisees should have been the shepherds of Israel. But they don't do what the sheep, the shepherds in the parable do. That's the important thing. The Pharisees should have been a shepherd to the people, but they're not. They don't fulfill the role they should have filled. They don't rejoice at searching. You know, the shepherds would happily bring home the sheep, Jesus, in Jesus' parable, on his shoulders. No grumbling, no heavy burden. They search without counting the cost. They don't just take a token look. They search until they find the lost sheep. And then they rejoice, as we said, with the community at the restoration. There's a party in the third parable. There's actually a party when the lost son is found. Verse 7 says that there is joy in heaven over one repentant sinner. There's an old rabbinic saying that said there is joy before God when those who provoke him perish from the world. But Jesus knows God's heart better than the rabbis did, because he was sent from God to give a different message. God's joy is not in the lost being lost. His joy is in the lost being found. But sadly, even in the church today, we behave more like Pharisees than the true shepherds that are talked about here. We are. Please admit it with me. I am. You are. We're a bit smug. And we are a bit self-righteous, which means we think we're righteous when we're actually not. So the point you see of the contrast here between the shepherd in the parable and the Pharisees is that the shepherd rejoices in the search. He celebrates with the community when someone gets rescued, when a lost one gets found, when somebody in trouble gets help. the shepherd rejoices. And third, he takes the initiative to find the lost. This is really the heart of these parables. The rabbis would agree that God could welcome penitent sinners, but Jesus takes it further. God is not only welcoming the penitent sinner, he is searching for the penitent sinner. He is seeking the one who is in trouble. He is seeking those who are actually running from him. This is the whole meaning of the New Testament's emphasis upon the outgoing love of God towards those who are wrong. God seeks those through the person of his Son who are running the other way. Now, in verses 8 through 10, we have the second parable in this trio. This one involves a lost coin. It makes the same point. In the Middle East, a peasant woman would have all of her wealth probably in gold coins made into like a necklace that she'd wear around her neck. And maybe the necklace came undone and one of the coins was lost. She gathered them all, but she couldn't find the one. Or she might have the coins in a rag she would carry around, almost like a kind of pocketbook or a purse. And she maybe dropped one out. Now, in the living quarters of peasants in the ancient Near Middle East, there would be a dirt floor, and there'd be high walls and windows only up at the top for security purposes so people couldn't climb in. So even in the middle of the daytime, it would be dark and dingy in a home. So a light is brought, it says. And when the light is brought, then she rejoices in the fact that she finds this coin. Again, this story, you've got to hear it with the ears of the Pharisee. They would hear it as a great insult to them. Why? Because it was such a simple, home place, down-to-earth illustration involving a peasant woman. This was intellectually beneath the sophistication of the Pharisees. And it was an insult to them. It was beneath their sophistication. This idea of taking a joy in people who have trouble in their lives. The Pharisees would scorn them. They wouldn't take joy in them. This idea of rejoicing in the fellowship of the community when one person who's in trouble is helped and found. And this idea of taking the initiative to find a lost precious object. Again, the way this is described is highly offensive to those who think they have it all together. To the Pharisees who don't rejoice at the searching, they really don't search at all because they really like the status of things the way it is. They like being comfortable in the community. They like their place in the community. They don't want anything to upset that. I have to tell you, the church can sometimes be like that. One time many years ago, in this very room, I was speaking with a man who's no longer here, no longer lives in Dallas. And he said to me, right there in the middle of the room, he pointed to a person who had come in the back of the room. And the person who came in was kind of disheveled and obviously a street person. They kind of had bags and things with them. And they obviously didn't, quote, belong in here. And that's exactly what my friend in the middle row told me. He said, Skip, I want you to know I went and told that guy that he shouldn't come in here looking like this. Didn't I do the right thing? And I stopped for a minute and I said, well, yes, you did the right thing. If you want him to look more like you than like Jesus. That's it, my friends. That really is it. Do we want people to look more like us? Or do we want them to look like Jesus? Do we want people to be found in their troubles? I mean, really honest. Where's the honesty? Where's the openness? Where's the sense of vulnerability among us that says it's okay to have a problem? It's okay that I'm not perfect. I know something about you you will not admit. You're not perfect. You've got lots of problems. And it's good to rejoice when such a person, as it were, knows he or she is free to speak about those problems. And when the community, instead of taking offense or isolating themselves or not having any answer to the person in trouble, instead rejoices that the problem has come out, that there's now a way that we can begin to deal with it. The church is the place of all places where I should be able to admit that I have a problem. And I shouldn't have to pretend, like the Pharisees do, that I have it all together. And the place the church should be is a place that actually takes the initiative to make it possible for people to admit that things are not perfect in their lives. These parables are an account of the infinite lengths that Jesus has gone to find us in all of our sin and all of our trouble. How far did Jesus go? How far? He went from the right hand of glory, eternally with the Father, to a dirty stable, and then on to a garbage dump outside of Jerusalem. You see, the true shepherd went so far as to be lost himself to God. That's why he cries out on the cross, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" He was lost so that you might be found. He was lost at great cost. And if you follow Jesus in his search, do you know where you will find him? How you will see him? You will see him, as it were, with the drops of blood, of suffering, coming from his life as he cares so deeply about others. The initiative of Jesus is the initiative of God. Jesus reveals to us the heart of God the Father. In Luke 19, Jesus takes the initiative by calling a tax collector named Zacchaeus. Again, a fellow who would not be popular among his own people. He sees Zacchaeus in a sycamore tree hanging over the street so that he can get a good look at Jesus as he goes by. And he says to him, "Zacchaeus," he calls him by name, and he says, "Come down here. I am going to be your guest in your home. I'm going to eat with you today." And the parable, or that story of the account of Zacchaeus, ends with this line: "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." To call a man or a woman lost is to pay them a high compliment, because it means Jesus is looking for them. Why are you here? Why are you here? Right now, why are you here? To learn about God? To worship him? Yes. But what about one another? We have more in common with lost people than we do with those who have it all together. We are all on the same side of the ledger. We are all lost in this sense. Even in our being found, even in our being, quote, saved, we are still lost. We still have troubles. We still have problems. We still have difficulties. We still need the Lord to come and help us. And we still need the body of Christ to be that body that comes and gives to us the life-giving message. You have been found. Jesus cares. It is he among you. The problem with the Pharisees is not their attention to the details of the law. It was that in keeping those details, they found their identity. In other words, their identity was in the keeping of the law. But Jesus says your identity is not in keeping the law. It's not being good, and it's not in looking good. Your identity is that you were lost to God, and now you have been found by him. And only this identity makes me joyful, like the shepherd, like the woman, and we'll find out like the father in the third parable. There is no joy in trying to pretend you are perfect. There is no joy in trying to pretend you are perfect. There is no joy in this church if we try and put on a good front to one another and we don't begin to admit, "I have problems. I have difficulties. I need the help of other people. I need God's help." It is in caring for the lost, in caring for the troubled, in caring for the confused, in caring for the one who sits next to you right now, in caring for the one who sits in front of you or in back of you, it is in that caring that you find your joy. The joy is in the community called the Church of Jesus Christ. Community means common unity. What is our common unity? That we have it together? Is that what our identity is? Of course not. Our common unity is that we are lost, we have troubles, we have difficulties, and we have been found by the great shepherd, and now we're about the risky but happy and joyful business of finding one another. A couple of a few weeks ago, Barbara and I went with a friend, at the invitation of a friend, to an AA meeting in far south Dallas. Let me tell you, it has been a long time since I have been in a room with such honest people. They didn't look like me, they didn't dress like me, they didn't act like me, and they didn't have my education, and they were not all together in the world's terms, but they were honest. And in their honesty, I was shamed. You know, all of us who are Pharisees, or who are recovering Pharisees, all of us need to learn to laugh a little at ourselves. Let me tell you how Barbara and I had a good laugh yesterday, driving back from a wedding rehearsal where we were Friday night in Brenham, Texas. Barbara was telling me this story. She said, she reminded me a few weeks ago, our son Chris was home for spring break, and we decided to take a few days with him in South Texas. And I had to stick around for an extra day, so Barbara and Chris drove down to Houston, and I flew down 24 hours later. Well, when Barbara left the house, she left a plunger, you know, a plunger in the downstairs bathroom of our house, hoping that her valiant, brave husband would use that plunger to some good remedial good in that bathroom, which was needed. And I did. And I fixed it. It was great. Everything was working fine. Only problem was I left the plunger right there in the bathroom. Now, that's not a big deal, except for the fact that we often have groups in our house for one kind of meeting or another, large groups. And even when we're away, we give people the key and say, come on in, use our house for a meeting. We had about 100 people that Tuesday night while we were in South Texas in our house. And every one of those 100 people who used the downstairs bathroom saw this plunger in the middle of the bathroom. And Barbara and I said, that's it. We're plungers. We're not perfect. We don't look perfect. Our house doesn't look perfect. We're not perfect because we're lost and we need to be found. And I commend to you the parable of the plunger. I commend to you that you let yourself be honest just a little bit about the imperfection in your life. In Galatians chapter 4, the people are starting to evaluate themselves again on the basis of their appearance. And Paul almost cries out with this question. He says, what has happened to your joy? And what's the answer? The answer is that it's been replaced by judgment for those Christians in Galatians 4. They're starting to judge one another on the basis of appearance. They're starting to evaluate one another on how they keep the law. They're starting to measure one another on whether or not they look good, act good, are good. My friends, the church is a fellowship of those who do not look good, who do not have it together, who do not have everything all buttoned down and neat. Recovering Pharisees only have joy when they can laugh at themselves and then rejoice in searching out other recovering Pharisees and helping them to be honest about their need for the Lord. We approach one another in the church either with the judgment that comes from a hard rigidity in our own hearts, which may mean we haven't really understood the gospel at all. We either approach each other with judgment or we approach one another with joy. Judgment is easy. It's expected. It's really something that happens, unfortunately, quite naturally. But joy, why, joy is surprising. Joy is unexpected. Joy is amazing. Amazing. Amazing.